Whether you're dealing with doze and heat and bucks and rut, the winter blues, the marathon of kidding season in the spring, or show season in the summer, Nate Funk and John Kane of Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast, are with you every step of the way, bringing you interviews from various breeders, judges, and others from all over the country. We're always covering the latest ADGA news and covering topics to help make us all better dairy goat breeders. What's up, everyone, and welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. I'm John, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Nate Funk. Nate, how's it going, man?
Going pretty well. Beautiful weather up here in upstate New York. You know, that great Nate weather forecast.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm going to get you a green screen, and we're going to video every single podcast so we can have, like, the country map. And you can show all of the big systems moving through.
No, things are going pretty well up here. We have one doe left to be bred. We're done with breeding season. We're kind of in that sit and wait
mode. Show off.
How about you?
Well, I'm still breeding does, but waiting for one to come in and hoping that this AI sticks. I thought she was coming into heat yesterday, and she's not. So we'll see. But anyway, Nate, we have a guest on this week.
We do.
We're welcoming longtime listener and friend of the show, Ashley Scheel. Yay! Ashley breeds togs under the herd name AK Acres from Wisconsin. Her husband Kyle and her farm their land. Ashley is an agronomist and supermom of two littles. She's also highly involved with the WDGA and a licensed ADGA judge. Where she finds the time, I really don't know. But welcome to the show, Ashley.
Hi, thanks for having me on tonight. I really am excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. We started talking basically because you listened to the show and you started messaging us and starting conversations, and I'm really glad that we can have you on today.
Yeah, no, I like to kind of, I also listen to Goat Gab, and you know, when there's just kind of topics that like you maybe have questions or maybe a future recommendation on, I think it's neat as a community, we can kind of all continue to enjoy the couple of really good podcasts that we have going on in the industry right now. So yeah, really happy to be here today.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, Ashley, for those that don't know you, can we get a little background in who you are and how you're involved with ADGA and dairy goats?
Yeah, so going back to kind of the grassroots level of where it all started, I actually grew up on a farm in northern Illinois, and with my found allergies to dairy cattle, or to dairy cow's milk. My parents actually got into goats when I was younger. And through the years, I've had multiple breeds because I think everyone goes through like the Nubians are cute. I want those when I'm younger. And then you kind of evolve as you grow up. But I've been around goats since I was two. And AV Glacier View Farm is the childhood herd my parents maintain in Richmond, Illinois. And mm-hmm. I grew up, my parents milked dairy cows for a long time. And so growing up around cattle was kind of my original exposure to farming. And then I had the dairy goats and then also showed beef and swine as well through the years. So that's where that started. And then I went off to college at UW-Platteville in Platteville, Wisconsin, and graduated with a degree in agriculture education. And I got my license to judge dairy goats at 18, which simultaneously put me through college and allowed me to judge a lot of really neat shows and to see a lot of countryside and help fund my way through school. And then when I graduated college, I went to remain a resident in Wisconsin. And now I'm located near Madison, and I met my husband. He was actually one of my very first clients as the co-op local agronomist, or crop specialist, for those who don't know what agronomist is. A lot of people look at me funny because they don't know what that term means. but anyways, so he was the one of my very first customers, and I basically was the crop advisor, and I always said I would probably go away and marry a farmer, and that I would probably never come back home because I wanted to get out of Illinois and into more of a agricultural setting, because Illinois has gotten a little more it's a lot more condensed with the urban sprawl that kind of comes out from Chicago and Northern Illinois. Yeah. So anyways, never looked back, and I've been in Wisconsin ever since. And so I've been an agronomist for going on 11 years, and Kyle and I were married back in 2013, and with our two kids, Rhett is 7 and Annie is 2, and we have our herd, AK Acres, with our Toggenbergs, as you guys said, and the rest is history. So here we are.
Now,
go ahead, Nate.
I'm going to go on this. Now, you say an agronomist.
Yep.
A crop specialist.
Yep.
Just what does that entail? What do you do with that?
Yeah, so that could almost be a whole episode in and of itself into some of the what dives into that.
A synopsis.
Yes, yes. So keeping it brief, basically crop rotation and management of your resources on a farm with, like, are you buying commercial fertilizer? Are you applying manure? How much crop uptake is it going to take for nutrients in the field? And what seed should you get and plant at what rate per acre? And looking at how all of that balances as a system is basically what people would pay me for. And so I did a lot of consulting privately on farm. And then for part of my career, I did the sales for the fertilizer and seed and chemical that goes on the fields. And then I got more specialized into nutrient management, which is strictly worrying about the fertilizer and manure and optimizing that. So that's kind of in a nutshell where my focus of my career is at now. And I actually work for – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I work for the state of Wisconsin at the DNR, where I am a nutrient management plan reviewer. So I used to write the nutrient management plans that people submitted in. And now I'm the one reviewing it for any farms that are greater than 1,000 animal units. They have to have a permit in the state of Wisconsin. Okay. And so I basically oversee, you know, their manure and fertility management plans.
We used to love the agronomists growing up because they always brought the cool seed hats.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, those are kind of coveted. They always had the swag.
Yep.
Like
yep.
A Funk G.
Yep. And nowadays, I think that's evolved into Yetis and more like high end, like Carhartt
coats
and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
Depends how many bags of seed you buy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would never. I might get the keychain level.
Yeah.
No. But moving on. The topic of the week this week is about that last portion before the agronomist part that I mentioned in the intro. You're an ADCA judge, and being a judge, we tend to forget most judges are breeders too. So with that comes a certain level of expectations, either for yourself or from your peers. That said, how has your judging career from 18 on evolved your breeding choices, showing, and career post-college?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. I like to think of my goat career in almost two phases. My childhood herd that I mentioned that I grew up with in Illinois, I kind of left that be with my parents when I went off to college. I still, you know, kept up with it and everything. But then once I was away at school, you know, things kind of evolved from there. I saw a lot more new herds as my judging picked up around the country. And I don't mean to sound like I'm some jet setter or anything, but you get out and you definitely get to other states and you expand your horizons. And so what's sort of neat is now in my herd today, it's cultivated such an amazing avenue to move forward with a herd now that I've seen so many different ones throughout my, like, my college years when I was judging. And so my current herd now really evolved from kind of picking and choosing some cool genetics that I saw in my travels and it kind of brought us to where I'm at now with AK Acres with my husband. So I think that's the coolest thing when I started judging, that's kind of led me to where I am at right now. And I took a small break when I had my kiddos for a few years, just because judging and like having infants in the house is a hard, that's hard. But
I can imagine.
Even in that few years though that I was stepped away and then you come back, it's just amazing to see the genetic progress that happens in areas that I hadn't been for a long time. And so the fresh perspective that being a judge has allowed me is something I'm always forever thankful for, because I don't feel like I could ever really get stale in our barn, because I'm always seeing something new to push me to consider other things in our decisions on the farm with genetics that we use. So
now, is there like a downside, or, you know, to going off and seeing these and going,
Yeah. So that's kind of the part that I brought up to John. I said, you know, it can be tough as a judge too, because you do go out and you're always getting a snapshot of what people bring to a show. And sometimes you come back and you're like, dang it, like we're really far away from where I think maybe I should be after looking at some of these other herds over the weekend when I was off judging at X, Y, or Z. So it always brings back a perspective to my barn of sometimes positivity and sometimes negativity. So one thing my husband and I always have to kind of rehash out when I come home from a judging assignment is, how do our ideals compare to the ideals of what I saw over that judging assignment? And it's not like we do this every show, but there are some shows where I come home and I'm like, my goodness, like that was quite an amazing group that I just got to see. And I think we have some ideas that we need to talk about for future prospects. So it can be kind of like, it's a really hard thing to rein in sometimes. And my husband's very calm and just very methodical about that stuff. And he kind of reels me in a little bit sometimes. He's like, you know, we just kind of got this buck. We're going to see how this rides out. But sometimes I get a little bit ahead and I want to try something new, maybe a little prematurely. So I always kind of have to go back to my goats and look at my own goals and my own ideals and just kind of balance that when you kind of are coming in and out of different styles and different herds throughout the country. And the one other thing someone really kind of brought out at a TC is, remember that the California goats or like the Pacific Northwest, we don't grow the same kind of goats everywhere across the country. It's not universally the same. And access to hay and feed is so geographically dependent that also is something you have to think about, the managerial options that we have throughout the U.S. So I thought that was kind of a neat point to have thought about over the last several years.
For sure. And you mentioned going to areas that you hadn't been to a while and seeing the changes, either for better or for worse, usually for better, the progress that is made. You know, COVID hit. Everyone, for the most part, was home for the year, not showing. So that creates a bit of cabin fever for yourself and, you know, the other people. So you're dealing with your herd and seeing a few maybe on Facebook or social media, but you're not getting your hands on them. But now we're open back up this year, right?
Right.
And we're seeing all these herds and what's changed and the progress that's been made. Did yours change through that time as well? Or did you, I feel like for like me, mine kind of got a little bit better, but then I see some other herds and I'm like, wow, they really stepped up their game in this last year and a half.
Yeah. And so for us, it was really ironic because I dipped into some genetics right before COVID that were definitely new for us. We've always had a little bit more West Coast influence in our Toggenburg origins of like our foundation animals. And so some definite hefty size to them. And I went back to some, I guess you would say some purebred origins and also some just smaller genetics, like just overall, I was looking at more correctness and body type and less focused on size, because I know that that's something I have an affinity to be drawn to, is like the larger bodied animals. Yeah. just in my own barn.
Yeah,
in the show ring, bigger doesn't mean better. I just, in my own ideals in my barn, I have to just watch that. And so we actually took some pretty big genetic risks, figuring like COVID isn't fleeting. This is around for a while. So you know what? Yeah. If we're not going out to all these shows, why not kind of take some closet risks and see what happens? And we did. And it's very not typical in my barn right now. I'll just say that. It's not bad, but it's not something I walk in the barn and I'm almost uncomfortable sometimes because my kid pen is just, it's not what my typicals would have looked like pre-COVID. So normally I have I've never had a yearling milker a dry yearling in my barn in 10 years.
Oh, wow.
It's never been a thing. And this year I actually have a couple does that have to be they're not small per se for their age, but they're definitely not as large as my usual size would be at this point. So we're going to actually hold a few back and we'll have a couple dry yearlings for 2022. And just rump structure is a little bit different. We gained a little bit of different structure to the front ends, which was a good thing. It was an improvement. But what I was trying to do is kind of add some control to some of that size that we were seeing, because I don't want to have premature burnout on my does just striving for all this size and really mature animals at a young age. And I just wanted to really focus in on some of the structure of our front ends and structure of feet and legs and see if we could balance that with some of the size so it could last longer over time. So I definitely saw some of the improvements I was after, and I wanted to see what we sacrifice when we go after those really strategic things. I feel like we had dialed in mammary systems where I was happy with it. And so you kind of got to pick, you're not going to fix everything in one generation.
No.
So you kind of got to, you know, bit and piece that together. So we took some genetic risks during COVID, and, you know, a couple I probably will send down the road if the udders aren't exactly what I'm hoping for. But overall, I'm liking what I'm seeing. But, you know, through change, you just, like I said, I'm a little uncomfortable with a few of them because I'm not familiar with that look in my barn. My yearlings have to freshen by the time they're turning a year. My yearlings usually need to freshen. So
yeah, I feel you on that. I mean, with some uncertainty, there's definitely uncomfortableness to it. I'm in the same boat as you with two herd sires that one's got one udder under his belt and the other one's just a, you know, yearling right now. So there's the uncertainty there for sure, and it can be uncomfortable.
Yep.
But you don't make progress without taking some chances.
Right.
That's exactly right. And I feel like if you talk to all the right breeders who have had experience maybe with a foot in the same sandbox you're standing in, but have also kind of taken some of the risks you're aspiring to take, I feel like there's a lot of value in that. And with the resources we have with, you know, linear appraisal showing and milk records and everything, I think people can make some pretty good educated choices. So
yeah.
Well, and you've got some pretty nice, you know, tag herds out there in the Midwest, upper Midwest there too. So
yeah.
We're talking to one of them, Nate.
I know. Well, you'd mentioned the Thompsons there too before the show. You know, they're there too.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Anna and I tend to talk quite a bit because if there's anyone who if you need to talk Toggenburg genetics with, Anna is like the resource powerhouse for all of the historical herd knowledge and genetics.
Absolutely.
So
yes,
always contact her and I say, hey, Anna, I feel like I'm stuck. Like, give me some like knowledge of what you think this would look like. And she's always so nice to answer the questions. And I enjoy her methods of just kind of posing different viewpoints on looking at genetics, but she's done a lot of research in togs and is such an avid historian and wanting to maintain some of those records. So she's really neat to talk to.
She definitely is. We've had her on before and I've had some fun conversations with her, and it's like she's like unlocked the sacred tablets of the history of the breed, and she's really, really smart cookie.
Yes, and she actually, through the National Toggenburg Club, there's been some recent discussion about, she's had a lot of diving into the history of the breed at its origins, and kind of looking at some of the color, like with the black tog and different things. And so it'll be very interesting to see what she brings forth through all of her culmination of research that she's been doing over the last few years, I think. And so I look forward to hearing more about that, because she's really got a gift for figuring a lot of that out in a way that appeals to, you know, finding the valuable pieces that make a difference to the current time.
So. Now, right.
Now, you hit on something that I kind of have a little itty bit of knowledge of, the black togs.
Yeah.
We have other listeners who don't know what you're talking about there. What do you mean by black togs?
Right. So the Toggenburg breed is legendarily known for being the medium brown, typically dark chocolate, maybe with white trim. And so with that being said, there is on occasion some variations to the brown, or you can get a black instead of a brown. So this is not an American Toggenburg trait, or necessarily just a purebred Toggenburg trait. It's, I believe, what is a recessive that hangs out in some of these bloodlines that, when paired up correctly, will express itself. And the downside is we don't necessarily know how repeatable this always is, because it's always been kind of not looked upon favorably. So I think there's been a lot of blacks that just get sale barned or don't get registered. But mm-hmm. I've had a couple black togs in my herd. And I mean, there's one that's been out there doing fairly well. And I make a point to have gotten her out and showed her in association with collaborating with a lady who bought her. And the black tog thing, it's, if you take a buck out of a black tog doe, it usually helps darken some of the lighter brown that we've yep. seen come into the breed. So it's sort of something that I've talked to a few avid tog enthusiasts about, that, you know, although it's not preferred in the show ring, if you look at breed character on the scorecard, but is it something we maybe need to re-examine as a breed? Because it is in fact going to help us maintain some of that more correct brown by utilizing mm-hmm. some of that to our advantage. So it's kind of a neat, that's a definite tangent, but just something
yeah.
that I think it's something that I think is really neat to bring up, and I'm glad you asked, but that's kind of about where that goes. And some of Anna's research, like I said, goes back into some of those origins that include some of those black togs that existed. So,
mm-hmm. So Anna's father, Doug, and my father, both, you know, date back towards, you know, mid 60s, we'll just say, on the Toggenburgs. So this past year at Louisville, I, you know, was watching the show with my father, and we noticed that I believe we saw a couple black togs go in the show ring.
Well, they can go in the show ring. You just probably won't places high well, up.
That's the thing. Is they were very, conformationally, they were sharp. They were really nice does. But they got, I'll use the term dinged. They got dinged for breed character mm-hmm. and pulled back a little further down the line than, you know, any other animal of a similar structure would have gotten. That's kind of why I delved into that, because you mentioned the black togs, and, you know, we'd had he and I had the discussion, and shortly after we'd had, I think we'd had Anna on earlier in the spring and summer. So that's why I was probing there. Thank you for
that. I'm going to shift gears.
Get us back on the road, John. Get us back on the road.
yeah, gladly. So, Ashley, judges have their own ideals that can differ from the scorecard, but at the end of the day, the scorecard is what drives their placings in the ring. So is that hard to balance that as a judge?
I believe, like, you know, in my own opinion, like when I am in my barn versus in the show ring, I definitely wear separate hats. And it's not that like I don't regard the scorecard in my own program, but like I definitely know where some of my own personal ideals are very apparent in the barn, but I know that those can't, you know, influence me in the show ring. And an example of that is I have been an advocate of like a black tog, and that's not necessarily good with everybody, but I know in a show ring, because I like black togs, that doesn't mean that they win the class. So I just had to kind of tie that in because it is something where, that is an area for an example where it can be frowned upon. Yeah. Like, oh geez, like she's an ABGA judge and like, here she is like bringing a black tog out. Like what's up with that? But the thing is I keep those very separate, but you have to just make sure that you're very conscientious of not letting any personal bias with your style or kind of your flair in your own herd come out too strong in the show ring in a way that is very, you know, inappropriate, which you wouldn't have a license if that was the case. But when you first get into judges training, it's, you know, there are similar point categories and you have to really look at how you weigh those and the overall form and function. And it's all about comparative reasoning. So, you know, when you're in the ring, just making sure that what you're seeing makes sense, it's justified in the scorecard. And, you know, like at home, I may really nitpick at that doe with teats I can't stand. It's 4 points on the scorecard. But in the show ring, you know, I wouldn't pick at a doe in the exact same way that I would at home, if that makes sense.
No, it does.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense.
So that's kind of those things where you just have to make sure that you're weighing it appropriately. So at home, I know I have the freedom to choose to scrutinize my does however I feel like it meets my needs in my own particular breeding program. And then in the show ring, I'm obviously following the scorecard. And I mean, like I said, the scorecard drives you at home, but you can choose to have personal opinions on like what you really want to work on.
Let's face it, you got to like what you're looking at. It right. might be correct scorecard wise, but you, the owner, the breeder, have to like what you're looking at, what you're producing.
Yep. And I agree with that 100%. And the one other thing that gets to be something that I think is a little bit hard is because some people have seen my herd before and they maybe know my style. I feel like sometimes they assume that that's how that carries over into the ring. And sometimes they use that to an unfair critique. And sometimes they like knowing a certain style of a judge because then they think if their herd's similar, they'll do better underneath them. And that's always something that's made me a little bit uncomfortable because I know that it can get a judge unfairly scrutinized sometimes just because I think that style in people's minds like travels with them. And in some cases it can a little bit, like, you know, if you're looking at general appearance on a senior doe and then a mammary system on a senior doe, you have 35 points in each area. I mean, there can be some areas where they're fairly close in points, and in that pairing, it may look like they're favoring something and it may be similar to the style of their goats in their own herd. And you can sometimes hear some feedback that, like, you know, I can definitely tell the style you're going for because it's very similar to what you have. And that's not something that I want people to think that judges, you know, really focus on. It's purely what am I looking at in the ring, comparing them 1/2, 2/3,
right,
and how you look at that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I just try to make sure that, like, with anything in the show ring, that, you know, if I ever received a question or a comment on something, which is pretty rare, that, like, someone would question you, I just always try to make sure that, like, if someone has a question in relation to maybe my herd and my ideals, I try to make sure to keep those professional and separate, because I tell them, if you want my opinion, I'm giving it. It's not an opinion that's like a personal opinion. I said, I'm going to guide you to the scorecard. So if someone comes up to me after a show and says, hey, I noticed in this placing, you said this about my doe. Can you tell me what about this I could work on? And I say, well, you know, the doe in front of you may have had the slight advantage in front end assembly with general appearance. That is something that, you know, when comparing those two does, might possibly be something to look at with yours. But I always still try to give the positives to them about their doe too, because that's always the goal in judging, is never to degrade. It's always just to compare.
Right. So.
Right. Yeah.
Nothing personal. It's just the scorecard lined up 1, 2, 3.
Yep. So.
Sorry.
Oh, no. I was going to say, so hopefully that clarifies that in a way that's, you know, seems appropriate, because that could be a real can of worms if you want to open it up deep enough, because there are definitely like ideals in every breeder's mind. And when you're a judge, you have to keep those separate. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is you're there to assess those animals in that condition, in their current condition on that day. That given day, in that given situation. So, I mean, it doesn't matter the animal's past. It's just what it is there in front of you as a judge, and you look at it with a scorecard, and hopefully, in an unbiased manner. Makes sense.
Well, speaking of shows, me being me, I tend to hold my goats over the fire. Nate can probably agree with that. Mm-hmm. Especially when I'm at shows, where maybe if they aren't competing as well as I thought they would, or I just know there's better animals there, and I tend to just want to kind of burn them all and start over. Not really physically burn them, folks. Calm down. so being a judge, is it hard to see some like really stupendous animals that may be better than your herd, and you know you come home and look at your herd and maybe you feel the same way, or do you just trust your own process at that point?
So back kind of in the beginning when we started the episode, when I was kind of talking about how my husband kind of balances things and kind of reels me in sometimes, I think that's where it's really good to like, if you're a judge, I think having an accountability partner within your own herd and knows your program, whether it's maybe not even someone in your own family, but maybe a local breeder that you're friends with. But I think it's really important to make sure to talk to people. If you're a judge, when you get home, if you're having some of these like conundrums of like, oh, I just saw the most beautiful doe out in Texas or Florida, and dang it, my herd should be up to that standard. And why am I not there? Or how do I get there? And I always have to talk to my husband when I get home sometimes. And I first off, like, you know, you fan club what you just judge. You're totally all about it because they're beautiful animals.
Right.
But the other thing is we break it down. Like, where did we just step into the place we're in over time? Like, how did we get to where we are? And why are we kind of have to go back through our decisions and make sure that we remember sometimes when we're feeling kind of burnt out, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. I will admit, with some of the genetic progress that we've been trying to make with some bolder moves, you know, some of the goats I saw this summer, I came home and I'm like, I'm not sure where I think I am right now. And that's just something that like me and my husband both struggled to talk about sometimes, because he's still like, I loved our, like, he loves big goats too. Like, he just loves that West Coast size. And so he's like, it's just not the same in the pens right now in the kid crop. So it's just really hard to look at them in the same way until we really learn how they mature and grow. And mm-hmm. I said, I would agree, but I'm like, we have to be patient with the process. And just because I went and saw something that I came home and said, you know, was the best thing ever, doesn't mean we're scrapping what we have or we should immediately get rid of them. But what I will say, though, is when I've looked at some herds that I've considered bringing into our program and then look how they've crossed on other stuff that maybe I do have.
Yeah.
It's really eye-opening to see how maybe some genetic pairings don't work for other people.
Yeah.
So that's a big, I'd say a big perk to judging too is I sometimes come home and I'll be like, hey, I saw this or that. And I don't know if that would work for us. And it goes good both ways, I think, but you do catch yourself in that light of, okay, I do think that we might need to move this one down the road. And I think specifically being a judge has made me harder on my yearling crowd, not dry yearlings because I don't usually have any, but yearling milkers.
Yep.
And I've had to learn a little more patience with like letting them mature.
Oh, oh, oh. John.
Oh, stop it.
So sorry, that's a good one because you see like over time when I've had repeat visits to certain areas with different herd or with some of the same herds, it's mm-hmm. been interesting to watch some does I remember judging as a yearling maybe get to be older and seeing which ones have held up and which ones haven't. And in the show ring that day, you're judging them as they are.
Yep.
But just because that yearling is first place underneath me this year doesn't mean she would be the first place 3 or 4 year old a few years down the line.
And or even if she's there at all.
Right. And if you notice, like we talked about our maturity differences, how we might need to slow things down a little bit in our herd and kind of balance it. So that's mm-hmm. kind of somewhere where I feel like yearling milkers have really taught me a lot the last several years because there's just so much to be learned at looking at how that one doe can be just perfectly immature. I've seen a few really prominent breeders say, I just love how perfectly immature this yearling is because she's going to last. She'll be a late bloomer, something like that. So
I've heard that a lot this year. I tell you, similarly, I added Guernseys this year. And the two that I got, they're beautiful Guernseys. But compared to my Oberhasli, I've had to retrain my eye and not just cut ties with them right away. Because for Guernseys, they're pretty stellar. For dairy goats, the breed needs work as a whole. So mm-hmm. it's definitely like caused me to just kind of take pause and see them for what they are and for what I can build off of. And I kind of get that from shows as well. Cause like I said, I mean, Nate knows there's some shows where if I'm getting my butt whooped, I walk away and I'm like, well, all right, we got to scrap our whole project and start over. And
then
if I were a judge, I'd probably be going crazy. Cause you see some stupendous herds throughout the country.
And then we spend the next 2 weeks rebuilding John's ego.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
It's like if you see some of those memes on Facebook, like what would the self of you now say to like your 18-year-old self or whatever, mm-hmm. you know? But like if the 30-something-year-old judge in me now could tell something to the 18-year-old judge then, it would have been to calm down a little about my own genetic decisions based on what I saw in the countryside, because I didn't have the patience then that I do now to see some of these genetic advancements through multiple generations, because we had a real good streak several years ago where, you know, it got really easy to be pretty comfortable with where we were at because we did consistent at nearly all the shows we went to. And then as we took some more risks, we weren't necessarily seeing all of our does in the same consistent way at every show. But then when they start having babies and their babies have babies, I mean, you start to see where you were aiming to get to, and you see some of that consistency balance back out again with some added strength that you wanted to see in your program. And I wished when I was younger, I had had that insight to now handle things the way I do now.
I can imagine as an 18-year-old, though, that had to be pretty hard to grasp. Like, I couldn't imagine.
Well, and then, like, I was still raising goats with my family back home. And, like, the financial obligations, I mean, I helped cost shared the whole project as a whole. Like, when we bought animals, they just weren't bought for me. But you know, my parents obviously owned the property and the barns and all that. And it takes a lot of resources to raise really good animals, period. Yeah. That's just how it is. And so my parents always allowed us the opportunity to have the animals we were our ideals. But then they would help cover some of the like cost of the feed, and they would always give us facilities to have them in. And once that's no longer the cushion to sit on when you're graduated, starting your own life, I mean, I look at things a lot differently now, because it's like, well, I don't just get to go out and buy a new fancy goat. I need to like worry about the facilities I'm raising said goats in. So that's kind of where some of that, I think, comes as a really big evolve over time. And I've become more patient because, you know, I might a few years ago have thought like, okay, you know, I wish this group of kids looked a little nicer, but then I'm like, you know, could there be some facility advancements that could help me raise them even better? And maybe there's something in management I can tweak, which is another discussion, but it's just, you have to learn to balance that with your eye and kind of some of your exposure over time.
Right.
Well, and sometimes I think you get that kid, and you know, we have a few in our barn where you look at them and you're just kind of like, what happened here? But you, as you said, you've got to be patient. Mm-hmm. And it might not be that dough, that specific dough, that gets you to where you want to be. It might be her offspring.
Or her granddaughters, you know, or grandsons. Or I was going
to say granddaughter or grandsons that get you to where you want to be. Yep. You just got to be, as you said, you've got to be patient.
Right.
I think that's something we all need to remember.
And, right. You know, let's not forget that being a judge doesn't mean that you have to have a nationally renowned herd. Like, yeah, it would be great for us, you know, for everybody to have a amazing nationally renowned herd, but judges are people too, and most are breeders too, and we're all working towards the same goal of, you know, creating that national champion or you know, premier breeder, you know, whatever. You know, judges are people too.
Yep. And that's one of the things that I kind of wanted to like elaborate on as part of this episode, because over time, I mean, as you judge more, you see more, you know more from just experience over the years. I've had long enough now to kind of know how certain shows will go, because, you know, you get people that will ask you questions, and then like ringside, they'll ask me like, hey, what do you think of this dough versus this dough? And this is just me as an exhibitor. I should have like prefaced this comment. But like when you're just somewhere as an exhibitor, sometimes there's some really high intensity of inquiry that may come your way, especially when someone has that group of like four junior kids that they're trying to see who shakes out in the class to keep two, you know? But you do get asked a lot of opinions, and I hesitate with that, because my opinion that day is just that day. Right. And I tell them, I'm like, you know, you're showing them here for an opinion, but you still need to go home and watch them grow, because their structure changes as they change and grow. Like sometimes when they're growth spurting, they might look a little taller in the hips and they don't show as well. And so I always just, you know, as I'm showing and being the breeder and the wearing the judge's hat, I just always try to be careful, because I know people put a lot of, like, if they're coming to you for an opinion, you got to be really careful how you portray that to them. And I always say, well, I can tell you what I think of them right now, but I'm like, just make sure you don't like, don't weigh that out for all that it is and make your decisions strictly based on what I tell you.
Right. And you know, it does a place well, it gets called because the judge said so.
And then the other thing too is sometimes my opinion outside of the show ring versus how they look in the show ring is different, because they might talk to me by my tack pen in the morning. And then when that doe goes in the ring that afternoon, she might be cold or hunched up because, you know, we judged in like the polar vortex this spring, I feel like.
Yeah, in May.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I mean, goats just look different. They show different. They place different depending what day and what time. And so I just always get a little bit apprehensive at shows to offer too much insight, because it's like when they're in the show ring, that's really like what can change the tables around versus them in their tack pen or them talking to me by my tack pen. So I try to make sure that I'm just really thoughtful of, like, if I do talk to people, just keeping that correct and in the right frame of reference. So that way then I don't ever make someone think that what they have there shouldn't, you know, continue on in their herd or something like that. And when I'm also in the ring too, I mean, I usually wouldn't also be giving an opinion of, like, someone's goat that you would be judging at all, because that's not a professional line you would cross. You know, I mean, like, I'm not going to go talk to you about your goats and then judge them the next weekend. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a very, very clear level of separation there. So when I'm talking about just talking to people about their goats, it's like I'm at a local show. I know them. I'm not going to be judging their goats. And so sometimes I almost even refrain from it now, because it just is too easy for people to just get a little bit wrapped up in the judge's opinion versus what someone says who is also a judge, you know? So just trying to keep some of that with people who, you know, understand what you're trying to say, but don't take it to the bank, I guess. Yeah. And make drastic decisions. So.
Right.
For sure. I mean, I can't tell you how many times somebody has messaged me and said, oh, the judge didn't like this one. And it's like, well, what do you think about this animal? What is it better than its dam? Is it propelling your program further? I mean, it's sometimes I feel like exhibitors forget to ask themselves the tough questions and just rely so heavily on judges, or, I mean, I guess relying on appraisers is probably a good thing, because it's point blank what the scorecard is. Really, I feel like people tend to just rely so heavily on you guys, and I'm sure that's a lot of pressure on the judges.
It can be. And like, what, as I've kind of mentioned to people over time, is I'm like, I can't, like, I would never insult a goat in the show ring. So like, I'm never going to tell you point blank, this one is a bad goat. And that's not how we are. It's all comparative. So when it's 1/2, 2/3 for X, Y, or Z, you just have to look at those comparisons and realize that, like, depending who enters that class, what gets talked about and how that shakes out could be entirely different show over show. So we just have to look at those comparisons. And if you start to notice trends, you need to take that back to your breeding program and then give that a good look. Because if you have a doe with a really questionable front end assembly, and it's been noted multiple times that the doe ahead of you is placing there because of general appearance and front end assembly, that's probably something to maybe be looking at. But in a different show, maybe the whole class is lacking in that area and they talk about something else that is actually her strong suit. Like, I have a doe that I would trade her front end out at any time, but she has one of the best mammary systems in the barn. That might be something that gets talked about at the next show, where front end may not be something we discuss as closely in that class because none of them have super great front ends. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because you're not going to compare 1/2 if she has a slightly better front end than that one that isn't really much better or worse, you know? So you have to just really hone in on the reasons in the class and make sure that you're looking at that subjectively to your herd and then what's in the ring that day. Because if they don't mention something, doesn't mean it may not be there. It's just they're assessing that pairing between those two does that day, you know, in that genetic or in that placement.
Yeah. And it depends, you know, for your program, how you want to take that judge's comments. You know, I've had judges say, oh, well, this yearling milker is immature compared to the three ahead of her, Nate. And the judge is correct. But I also know that she's a yearling and she's probably going to mature and deepen out and do all kinds of special things. And that's fine. But then there's also the comments, like, I've had a judge say, you know, this doe in second is really hockey. And you're like, excuse me? And then you look and you're like, oh yeah, she is. How did I not notice this?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's always important to listen to the judge, but also be able to decipher what the judge is saying and the reasons behind the reasons, right?
Yeah.
Well, and you kind of touched on something there, John. I don't know if it, sorry. to interject, go ahead. And sometimes so your animal placing fourth might not be it any other day, different competition, that animal could be first.
Yeah.
If the competition is just that much better, that there's three does in front of you, that doe is not a bad doe. She's just, those other animals are to some degree a little bit better.
You know? That's a very accurate statement. And that's a lot of the reason why, like in my own barn, I want to strive to get out of our own geography once in a while, because usually by area, you tend to see some of the same common strengths and sometimes common weaknesses. And mm-hmm. so it's good to kind of get out of your own geography sometimes to really put your herd to the test for a fresh perspective. Because you're only really going to hear about the things that are the commons that are amongst that group, because that's how they're getting, you know, shaken out in the ring, like how they're being compared. But I think it's really important that you really challenge your overall vision of what you're looking at by even getting out of that normal footprint. And so for us, every few years, we try to just pick something that's kind of out of anywhere normal we would usually go, and then just try to see how we stack up. Because when I judge in areas I haven't been to before, I go there and I'm like, wow, this is a different style than I'm used to. There is a lot different things I'm working with. And sometimes it's something that I wish I had my goats there to compare them myself, because mm-hmm. you're just, it's such a different style compared to what you're used to. So,
right.
And when people ask for opinions, like ringside at home, we're strictly analyzing what could be, or maybe what should be on our goats, just from like a friend to friend perspective. But yeah. when you get to these other areas and you're like, that's what could be, like, look at that doe. That's what could be. That's a pretty powerful tool to drive you. Cause you're not just imagining something, you're sometimes able to look at it right away. So
yeah, I'm sure it can light a fire in your eyes, you know?
Yep.
So, with judging, what is there, like, is there a downside and upside to judging and seeing all these herds across the country? And also, what's your favorite part about judging? Cause it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So, the upside is always the genetic access and amazing relationships you form with people and getting to know them. There would be herds that I would have never met, seen, have no affiliation of knowing, had it not been for meeting them and judging their animals years ago. And that's actually how, you know, I have acquired some of my foundation animals today. And so I'm forever grateful for judging in that capacity. The negative side is that there's never enough time to necessarily take judging assignments, and I don't mean that in a mean way, but like, I want to go show my goats, because frankly, I owe that to my herd with where I've been trying to build it to get it to go. But every weekend that there's a good show, I get offered another, you know, like a judging assignment too, mm-hmm. is kind of how that always stacks out. So I always, in my mind, try to take one for the team on the holiday weekends and stuff like that every couple of years. Because if no one judges Memorial Day weekend, I'd never build a show Memorial Day weekend, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So I try to rotate that, because I'm like, you know, I'm okay with sitting one out every few years, you know, that would be fine with me. And also depends where the show is. Cause like this last year, my family and I vacationed in Colorado for a week because I judged out there. And so the balance of it is, it's hard to necessarily say no to assignments, but sometimes it's hard to say yes, just because your own program gets in the way. Figuring out who does chores while you're gone. Thank goodness I have a former dairyman as a father-in-law who milked cows for years, so he loves the goats. So I'm lucky in that regard.
Yes,
that he's
you
usually
are.
if I need to be gone, he's usually like all about milking and doing all that. His only a requirement is there's got to be a machine. So that I'm like, no problem. But like looking at your cost to be gone, what that means for you, because like judges all are allowed to set their rates and everything for what they do. And there's some basic guidelines that are kind of unwritten, I guess, you know, of like where do most people kind of price themselves out at? And sometimes it's hard because I'd like to be a little cheaper so I could do more assignments. But then sometimes my cost to go is just that high that like I know I'm not the most competitive. And that's just it kind of is what it is. But when I can, I always keep it as fair as possible on my fees and stuff, which isn't something we need to go into. But I just people just have to remember that it's like as a judge, the shows have a really strict budget. And they really need judges at some of these shows. They can't always get people until the last minute because they have to search so hard. And it's a matter of economics and travel access and all of the things. And so I try to always be as fair as possible to my own family in making sure we get out to show at shows. And then I also try to make sure I'm fair to the community that got me to this point in the dairy goat world. And I make sure to, you know, get out there and judge shows too, since I do hold a license. There were a few years during kids where I just couldn't. And that was a really hard thing for me because you feel very compelled to want to give back to the judging community or into the goat community by showing and judging as much as you can. So.
Yeah. I'm sure there's quite a bit of pressure there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so always remember if you talk to a judge and they have a certain fee associated, remember that someone's probably taking care of their goats at home. Remember that maybe they don't live close to an airport with good flight fees and some of that. Cause I have gotten some feedback from some clubs that's like, wow, like that's kind of high, but I'm like, I have minimums. Like I can't go to O'Hare in Chicago to take a flight out, even though it's semi drivable from here. I just don't have the option to take that time. So my local Madison airport, which is much smaller, the flights may be more expensive. And so trying to balance that to keep it affordable for the clubs and then also take assignments when I can be kind of hard. So,
what's your favorite part about judging?
Yeah. So my favorite part is, as mentioned, like the foundation animals that I was able to start with after college, I would never have met the people I know now, saw the animals I've seen and made the friends that I have. And I don't care if they're a Nigerian dwarf breeder, an alpine breeder, whatever it is, the people that span across the country that I've met make this world one that's like no other in the livestock industry. I think goats are a pretty unique set of people that all have such common, you know, goals and a caring nature for each other, even though we're competitors in the show ring. There's not a group that I've ever met like it. And I've shown in other, you know, I've shown cattle and I've shown pigs and other stuff that it keeps you coming back. And I absolutely love the community that I've grown to have due to judging. So
the community rocks.
It does. Every show I come back with like another connection on Facebook that like you just meet a friend through travel. And it's oftentimes even another judge because I don't get to meet all these judges. I might see 25 of them when we're renewing at a TC together.
Yep.
And, it's just really neat when I get to meet other judges and then also make other connections in the dairy goat world. And the social media side, I mean, you got to be careful with some of that. But like when you start to see some of these people time and time and time again, you become friends. So it's a pretty nice place and expanding my reach as I've gotten to travel to different areas has just been absolutely the best part. So
you meet a stranger and you're like, oh, you like dairy goats? Yeah. Do you? Yeah. Did we just become best friends? Yup. Like it's the best.
Right. And like, even through like my kids, like just if I were to travel to a very unique area that I don't normally go to, I mean, just now all the friends that I've made through judging, I mean, it's just, I feel like with my family involved, it makes it that much even more of like an activity you want to take them to, because you know other people with their kids and how they can become friends. And so that's been a really neat thing to see grow as like my family has grown.
Yeah. It's interesting, by the way, we use the word community. It's almost like a village. And in that sense, you mentioned with your with children, I've noticed that, like, we go to these spring shows, you know, these club shows, and the kids all gather up together and they go and play over there. And you can almost go, my kid is over there. And you know that that parent and that parent and that parent and that parent and that parent is watching the group. And that's kind of comforting.
Yes, it is. I will use the example. I was down in Illinois, Bloomington, for the Illinois Dairy Goat Association show. I think it's in June, but it was a six-ring show, 2 days, six rings. And I had my literal newborn with me. I think my daughter Annie was just a couple weeks old. And then I had my, I think, Rhett, my little boy, was about five at the time, or just not quite five. And, you know, you have your friends around you, and like one corrals your kiddo that's, you know, trying to play in the dirt pile over by their kids to keep them busy because they see you're trying to clip udders. And then another goat friend's, you know, grandma that's there wants to hold your baby for you. So it's just really sweet because it's literally like a giant family. And so I remember that weekend, if I didn't, like, my daughter didn't like to be set down, and she was never set down when she was a baby. So someone was always willing to hold her. And it was pretty sweet to see that, because I always used to look at like the toddler years and like, oh geez, like how do you take a little kid with to a goat show and really manage that? It just takes care of itself because you're a giant family. That's just how it goes.
Good. I hope Tierney's listening to this, because she literally brought up that same concern tonight. I was like, oh, I can't wait for this show and this show and this show next year. And she's like, Elsa's going to be running around and it's going to be crazy and you're going to be trying to show goats. And I'm like, dude, just chill. I'm like, there's always going to be someone to help.
Oh, yep. Goodness. I say we've got our three, and, you know, we started showing when our youngest was a toddler. And, you know, as I said, you got all these parents and grandparents. You know, people who are grandparents all watching your children, keeping an eye on your child. And, you know, even when you can't, they're there, you know, and you find yourself saying, stay with, you know, so-and-so. And it's like,
stay with Farmer John.
With Farmer John. My kids call John Farmer John. We have a friend that they call Aunt Trudy. You know, so they're not family biologically, but who says family has to be biological sometimes?
Yeah, definitely not in the dairy goat industry. It is purely by association of our common interest, which is dairy goats.
It really is.
Yeah. And with those relationships and stuff, I mean, it literally spans across states, across the country. And that's pretty special because, like I said, a few people, I mean, have I spent tons of time with them? Maybe not, but I've run into them at the national show or at a local club show, or I've judged and seen them through other things, and you just get to really form this community. And so pretty special. And I think judging has given me an extra front row seat to that, which is pretty cool.
For sure. I mean, look at us now. We're Nate and I are in New York, you're in Wisconsin, and we're talking about dairy goats over the internet. And it's because of dairy goats that we got to do this. So I mean, it's very unique. Ashley, thank you so much for being on. Was there anything you wanted to add?
So the plug I kind of wanted to put in was that if anyone out there has been, you know, considering ever wanting to be a judge, the goal of this and me coming on was just to realize that, like, your vision has merit to people. Your knowledge is important for the industry. And mm-hmm. you can make such a big difference with that. Just making sure that you understand that, you know, there are some expectations that come with it, but you can totally balance it and just make it matter for you and your family and your farm in the way that makes your world the best place. So for me, it's been, you know, I've loved the community I've built through meeting the people that I have in all of the travels that I've gotten to go on. And I enjoy the camaraderie that that brings for my family and my goat addiction, I guess you would say. But I also enjoy the professional establishment that I've been able to make through judging, because there have been people that through my career have helped me out because of goats. You know, learning different areas with cropping regimes that they utilize has helped me in my crop advisor roles that I've had to be through the years. So it just, you got to look at it as it doesn't just grow you in the goat sense. It grows you in the total professional sense and in your everyday life as well. And you're going to form connections that'll last a lifetime for you to take with you. So
I fully
agree. Very well said. Very well said. Yes, and hey, yes. Judges are people too.
Yes, that they are. That's the the other point of it too. I think that's how we phrased it, right?
Yeah. Yep. You know, I think that gets lost every once in a while, but yes, judges are people too. Yep. So be nice to your local friendly judge.
Yes. Yep. Much appreciated. And the other plug too is know that we have to take a lot of tests on all of the things that make a show go round when it comes to the paperwork and the different pieces. And judges have this very unspoken, I guess you would say, it's almost like a brotherhood of sorts, because if there's ever anything I can do to help a show, if they're shorthanded or they have a question on something, don't ever be afraid to reach out to another judge in that regard. If you're running a show and you have someone exhibiting who's a judge, I think that's important to know too, is, you know, make sure, don't be intimidated to ask us a question, and don't be afraid to, you know, like right now with some of the stuff in ADGA, there's been some very unique things that have happened on paperwork that some of us judges have been maybe lucky to only see once. And that's what all you hope you see it, that are some of these weird anomalies. But it's definitely helpful if, like, you don't feel bashful to ask some of these other judges, because they maybe have seen it in a different time or circumstance.
So. I could only imagine.
So. Yes. There have been ones that I hope I don't see again. So it's definitely been good to make sure to communicate well as a group. And like included in that is like some really advanced judges on speed dial on my phone, because you can run into some of the most unique things on a normal year. And because we've had some very unique circumstances with NG, I think it's been extra prevalent. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I can see that.
Ashley, if the listeners want to look up your Toggenbergs and your farm, where would they go?
Yeah, so my herd on Facebook is AK Acres and Shield Grain LLC, but if you just type in A-K Acres, you'll find us. But we have our cash grain farm operation page with our dairy goats. And so you'll see a little bit of everything about us on that page on Facebook. And then our website is a-kacres.com. And I will be the first to admit that it's probably not real current, thanks COVID. But we should have probably made a time to get that updated, but it's not totally up to date right now. So.
That's okay.
Facebook is the place. I feel like that's kind of the current website, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's good for social interaction and, you know. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but Ashley, thank you guys for having me on, though. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you guys and appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you for being on. We really appreciate it, and hopefully we'll have you on again sometime.
If you ever want to talk corn, beans, and alfalfa, I'm there.
Awesome. Right. I'm game for Perfect. That.
Yeah.
Well, again, Ashley, thank you. And Nate, thanks for joining in as well. Everybody, yep. This has been Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. I'm John. That's Nate and Ashley. We'll catch you on the next one.
Good night.
Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast, is not an affiliate of the American Dairy Goat Association.
All opinions or information regarding the ADGA does not represent the registry.